We now join the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting in progress with Dr. Allison Berry, with Willie Bentz, and the commissioners.
Exciting. We're moving in a positive direction. So the news is overall pretty good on the COVID front. We continue to see case rates, hospitalizations, and deaths decline at a national, state, and local level. We do continue to see a very high number of deaths in the United States. We're still seeing losing 1,200 of our citizens every day. And I think it's important to keep that in mind as we see these numbers come down. We still have quite a bit of transmission in our country. In Jefferson and Clallam counties, case numbers are coming down quite well. In Jefferson County, our total case numbers right now are 3,130. That puts our case rate at 189 per 100,000. So we dipped below the 200 cases per 100,000 threshold. Our percent positivity is 7.4, which is also downtrending. We have two of our residents currently in the hospital for a total of 114 hospitalizations. And we've had 28 deaths due to COVID-19 in our community. In neighboring Clallam County, our case numbers were up to 10,875. The case rate in Clallam is 132 per 100,000 as of today. Clallam does calculate that daily. In Jefferson, it's every week, so likely we will see ours downtrending over the course of the week as well. We have three of our residents currently hospitalized in Clallam and 105 deaths due to COVID-19. So numbers are very much moving in the right direction. We have been able to move out of the high-risk category into the moderate risk category as far as COVID-19 transmission here, which is very hopeful. Thank you, Commissioner Dean, for reminding folks that we do recommend continuing to mask in indoor settings, especially in spaces where the vaccine status of the other people is not known, and kind of crowded large group indoor settings. We do think that it is safe for most people to unmask once we get below that 100 cases per 100,000 threshold. But if you are high risk, we do recommend that you continue to mask until we get below closer to 50 cases per 100,000. Today does mark the first day that our schools have a policy where masks have moved from required to recommended. We are going to be working very closely with our schools, as we have, but even more so in the next few weeks, to try to support them as they make this transition. I want to acknowledge that for many parents and many kids, this is an uncomfortable transition. It's a challenge to figure out what to do in this new environment. We do still encourage everyone to continue to mask until our numbers get a little lower, but it is not mandatory at this time. There are a couple spaces it's important to remember where it is still mandatory to wear a mask. So in all healthcare settings, both as staff and as a patient. So if you're going to a clinic, it's really important that you do bring a mask. A lot of our clinics do have backup masks in case you forget, but we really encourage you to bring your own. Transit is still required. So if you're getting on a bus right now, you do still have to wear a mask. And in corrections and long-term care. So any of those very high-risk spaces, still required to wear a mask in those settings. We are seeing a lot of hopeful numbers around the country with significant improvements. We are closely following the situation in the UK, however, where we are seeing cases rise again and hospitalizations rise again. We're working very hard to make sure that that doesn't happen here, but it is an important cautionary tale. In the UK, they lifted all pandemic restrictions quite quickly. They not just lifted masking, but they also reduced access to testing and other critical mitigations. We intend to not do that here. So while we are moving away from mandating masking, we do still recommend it. And we do still have significant access to the other critical mitigations. We encourage people to use them. So even as COVID numbers go down, there are still people contracting COVID in our community. So if you feel sick at all, it's still critically important that you get tested right away. There are a lot more options for how to do that right now, but it's really, really important, especially if you are unvaccinated, because there are some critical treatments we want to make sure you get. And it's really important that you get tested right away so that we can make sure you can access those treatments. But anyone who's feeling sick, really important to get tested right away so we know what's going on and can get you the treatments you need if you do need them. Otherwise, I think the only other critical message I want folks to know is that when masking gets, when an individual mitigation goes away or people start unmasking, the other mitigations become actually more important, not less. There is a common tendency, it's understandable, we've been dealing with this for so long, that when everything's get better, to think that COVID is gone and everything's back to normal. And whenever we do that, we see a significant surge. So I think it is a time for celebration. We have done really well as a community to get things moving in the right direction. But I think I want to encourage everyone to be cautious and slowly remove those mitigations. So if you're starting to unmask in indoor spaces, that's okay. We still encourage you to, but we understand that many people are going to take off their masks in indoor spaces, but make sure we use everything else. Make sure you've gone forward to get vaccinated and get boosted. Make sure you're being thoughtful about, you know, how large those indoor gatherings are. Make sure you get tested if you're sick. If you are a business or a facility, make sure you're looking at the quality of the ventilation in your space. That makes a huge difference as far as reducing transmission there. So we need all those other interventions even more now as people start to take off their masks. We are going to remain vigilant at the Department of Public Health to make sure that we are there to respond if we see a rise in cases, and we are going to continue to contact trace the cases that we have to reduce any subsequent spread. One quick reminder, the Department of Public Health is considered a healthcare facility. So if you have business with the Department of Public Health, please do plan to wear a mask because it is still required in our spaces. And so with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Kate or Greg, do you have any? Kate.
Yeah, just a comment, and I'm not sure if you heard this earlier, Dr. Berry, but I want to say it for the benefit of KPTZ listeners too, that I was kind of floored to get a text on Friday saying that we had just dipped below the 200 cases per 100,000. And you predicted that. You picked that date 6-8 weeks ago. And I was just kind of astounded and really proud to have such a stellar health officer. So I'm just curious, can you speak to that a little bit? Like, I know the epi curves are somewhat predictable, but how on earth did you know that that is the day we would have hit under 200 cases?
Well, to be honest, we follow the curves, but they do have a range. And so March 11th was really the earliest we could expect to hit that number. But I didn't do that modeling. I was utilizing modeling done at the University of Washington through the Washington State Department of Health. There are lots of very impressive epidemiologists who do those models and update them regularly. And so we continue to follow them, see where the trends are going. And that is where we thought we would be. March 11th was the earliest time we thought we might hit that number. And so we were a little cautious. We wanted to make sure that we were really going to get to that place in time. But I think it does really speak to the power of this science. There are folks who have dedicated their lives to this work and to this kind of modeling. And the more that we really pay attention to that and let that guide our policy, the better we can do.
I'm sorry, I missed it when you said what the current 2-week case rate is.
We are at 189 per 100,000 as of Friday.
And, you know, yeah, nicely. I want to follow on that too, because it's great when projections are realistic and we can look at them in hindsight and say, yep, we are on the right path. And, you know, it feels like throughout this, we've been on the best path that we could be. So really thank you and Dr. Locke for helping us guide us with science. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I would add, I super appreciate your leadership, Dr. Berry. You've really, I studied science in college and did a lot of modeling around geology, rocks and different elements. And I'm reading a book right now about pupfish in Death Valley and how the saving of the pupfish actually paved the way for endangered species protection, which, you know, I'm just the little things that lead to future clarity. So I'm drawing a strange analogy, but I did have a question. So I got a news alert yesterday about Pfizer requiring a fourth shot, and a couple of people immediately reached out to me and said, what did I know about it? So sure. What do you know about that? Because you know a lot more than I do, I'm sure.
So yes, that was, there was a speech given by the Pfizer CEO saying they thought that a fourth dose would be needed. I think it is important to acknowledge where that message is coming from. It is coming from the Pfizer CEO and not from the CDC or from the State Department of Health. So I think there is some motivation there. We have not yet recommended a broad fourth dose for the general population. We do recommend fourth doses for people who are immunosuppressed. And many in our community are just now coming due for that fourth dose, actually, because they're the right period out from when they had their booster. So it is an important reminder that if you are immunosuppressed, if you're on cancer treatments, if you're taking immunosuppressing medications, we do recommend a fourth dose for you right now. So it's really important move forward with that. There are some countries that have moved forward with a fourth dose for older individuals. So particularly some countries have recommended a fourth dose for people 75 or older. We have not moved forward with that yet in this country. We have not seen enough data to suggest that vaccine efficacy is actually significantly waning in that population. So we are continually monitoring that. If we see a significant spike in cases in that older age group, that would potentially move us in that direction. But we're not there yet. It's not a current recommendation. We're still seeing very good efficacy from the vaccinations and the boosters in that group. So the best is to go forward and get your vaccination and booster and to continue to wear a mask indoors until we get these case numbers a little bit lower. I do anticipate they will continue to downtrend in the coming weeks. And so you will likely have an opportunity to go unmasked in indoor settings in the next couple weeks. We're just not quite there yet.
Thank you. Any other questions from Kate or Greg? Nope. So I'm sure there was a list from the KPTZ listeners. I did not review them all, but
there were a few. It wasn't a very long list of questions, but there are a couple that I think are important to address. So the first one noticed a case discrepancy between our case numbers and what's being reported in the Seattle Times. So I did a little digging to try to figure out what was going on there. A little background just so that folks can understand case numbers. So whenever you see a dashboard that's at the federal level in a newspaper, the way that they get all those numbers is actually from us. So the initial source of all of that information is your county health department. So if you're looking for accurate case data, the place to go is actually the Jefferson County Public Health website, because that is where all those numbers start. Then we send them to the State Department of Health. They make their dashboard, and then the newspapers pull from the state dashboard. And they kind of do fancy data scraping to pull data into their dashboards. So if there's ever a discrepancy, ours is the most accurate. That's the source data that's becoming everything else. There was an issue in the last couple of weeks with actually the CDC's dashboard, which is where a lot of those newspapers get their numbers, that was scraping data from State Department of Health dashboards. And it was doing it in an incomplete way. So it was unfortunately undercounting cases at a federal level, which was very problematic in the last couple of weeks, you can imagine. The State Department of Health worked very, very hard to clear up that misunderstanding. And so now the Washington State data is accurate on the CDC website. It's accurate in the New York Times. It's accurate on the Washington State Department of Health website. It appears to have not yet been updated in the Seattle Times. So if you see a discrepancy, that's the only issue there. It's just a matter of pulling data from our websites. But ours is accurate. The State Department of Health website is also accurate. If you look at the Epi curve, you can follow our case rate there as well. Know that the State Department of Health website has a 1 week delay in all of their numbers. So you'll see that our numbers are actually higher on the State Department of Health website, and it's because it's from a week ago. Otherwise, this person asked, they were not clear about whether or not the mask mandate was being lifted. So I think important to be clear, the mask mandate is lifted in Clallam and Jefferson counties and in Washington state as a whole. We did kind of debut a risk dial so that people could make informed decisions about their mask wearing. We do encourage all of our citizens to wear masks indoors when we're above that 100 cases per 100,000 threshold, especially in any space where there are a lot of people around and you don't know their vaccine status. So we would really encourage that going forward. It does mean that in public schools, the mask mandate was also lifted. Again, we recommend masking in public schools right now because there are so many kids in particular who are not vaccinated. So we do recommend masking in that setting until we get our case numbers lower. The primary reason why we focus so much on case numbers is because that determines that the probability that someone in that room has COVID. Lots of things become safer when no one in that room has COVID. And so as those numbers get lower and lower, it becomes safer to do more and more things. Number three, this person asked, public health has been poorly funded by the government for many years. Do you anticipate more funding will be made available for public health and the tracking of potential pandemic risks in the years to come? And I would say, I sure hope so. Having worked in government service for a while for public health, we are used to being chronically underfunded. I do want to acknowledge that Jefferson County has done a lot of work to improve funding for public health. And so we are likely to be secure going forward, but many of us around the state have experienced the defunding of our departments in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Collin County has not been defunded either, but many of my colleagues have, when you look at especially some of our counties on the east side of the mountains. So I am not optimistic. I wish I could say that this was going to cause us all to value the critical role that public health plays in keeping us alive. I certainly hope that it will. And I think the more that we talk about our successes, we talk about the people that are alive now, and the more that we keep that in front and center in people's minds, I think the better that we can do. But I think it will be a challenge to encourage folks to continue to care for public health. There are a lot of things we do in public health besides COVID. We do maternal child health. We do a lot of work around chronic disease prevention. We make sure your water's clean. There's lots of things we've been quietly doing to make your life safer. And we would really like to do more work on those issues going forward. So I hope so. This person says, I've heard Dr. Berry predicting that the risk for transmission of COVID and therefore increasing cases possibly occurring this fall. Could there be another mask mandate at that point or a recommendation for indoor masking? I would say very likely we will recommend masking this fall because we are very likely to see a spike in cases. Right now, we plan on continuing to use that risk dial and updating it regularly so that the public can know where we are as far as COVID and what we recommend. We are largely transitioning away from mandates to recommendations, which is really more our bread and butter. In public health, we generally just give recommendations and encourage people to make healthy choices. And right now, wearing a mask in an indoor setting is a healthy choice. And we are going to encourage people to continue to do that. The trigger that would bring about mandates would be if we saw such a significant surge that we were starting to see critical infrastructure fail again. So if we started to see our healthcare system overrun, if we started to see the inability to provide critical public services because of how much COVID was going around, that would potentially change that calculus. But until we saw something like that, we are actually very unlikely to mandate masks again, but we will continue to inform the public about when it's a good idea to put on masks. And the more that we follow those recommendations as a public, the more that we can prevent any of those other things. If we all mask when it's recommended, then we don't see healthcare overrun. We don't see critical infrastructure damages happen that then bring about mandates. I don't think anyone in my profession actually enjoys writing mandates. I can tell you for sure that I don't. So I would prefer that we all move forward with recommendations. And I really encourage our population to follow those recommendations. It's important not only for your health, but the health of the people around you. And that is actually all of the KPTC questions I have today, but there are a few for Willie today.
Willie.
Yeah, I was actually very surprised when I opened up the KPTC question list and found I had almost as many as Dr. Berry this week. So certainly exciting. So the questions for me, I have no real update. Again, things are relatively status quo as we wind down. And that's actually what the questions from the KPTZ listeners were about this week. The first being, How long will our response and our EOC activation be going for? Are we still in response mode? What does that look like? And for all intents and purposes, we've demobilized many of our response activities. The Emergency Operations Center technically remains activated. We still have, virtually, of course, we still have some of our coordinating meetings between us and public health. We still have some informational briefings between us and our partners. The Policy Management Group to facilitate coordination between our electeds and leadership in DE and public health remains in place on a weekly basis. So we're still coordinating and sharing information, but a lot of our core response activities, we're really moving them into maintenance mode, kind of an ongoing programs. I know public health has changed their contact tracing protocol to a much more manageable level. We're supplying stores with masks. Vaccinations and booster doses are available through public health as well as through the healthcare system, rather than those large mass vaccination clinics. So we've scaled all those response activities back. What we are doing to fight COVID-19, we're in more of an ongoing maintenance mode rather than an emergency response mode. And we'll look at kind of formally closing out the EOC activation by the end of the month and look at sunsetting some of those meetings and going back away from our emergency response modes of coordination through just our ongoing day-to-day reporting mechanisms and things like that. So we're still not quite 100% there, but we are 95% of the way, I'd say, through our emergency response activation. The next question concerned whether or not we're going to maintain volunteer resources to be able to respond. If there is an additional surge or there are any additional needs that would require a lot of our emergency response volunteers. And the answer to that is absolutely yes. We had hundreds of people come forward over the past 2 years to help out with the response through my department, whether it be doctors or nurses who are actually administering shots. We had logistics volunteers who'd help with, you know, putting up parking cones and helping with traffic control or helping set up and clean up after clinic, things like that. So we are absolutely going to maintain those volunteer resources. We've actually taken a volunteer who helped out in the clinics. She's actually helping us out with some strategic planning around our volunteer program to be able to leverage this volunteer group to keep them engaged, even though folks are a little tired at this point. We're giving them a chance to rest, and we're hoping to bring them back into the fold and maintain that volunteer capacity. And we're actually going to be starting a program here pretty soon called the Medical Reserve Corps, which is a volunteer group of retired doctors, nurses, other medical professionals who can respond to both pandemics as well as other disasters in a volunteer capacity to help augment healthcare resources, provide support in other ways using their medical expertise. So it's something we didn't have before the pandemic, and we actually had to create it on the fly because we didn't have that capacity set up beforehand like some other counties. But we're looking at building that volunteer program, maintaining it, being ready for either the next additional wave, a future pandemic, or a future emergency, whether it be an earthquake or something like that. So definitely continuing to maintain that volunteer capacity. The final question concerned the possibility of any additional mass vaccination clinics, especially if there are fourth booster doses that have been recommended. At this point in time, I'm not anticipating it and that we're not planning on it, but if that need arises, we will certainly be there. It'll definitely be a combination of factors. We'll look to Dr. Berry and our colleagues in public health to let us know when we need to potentially pull the trigger on that. A combination of factors in terms of the urgency of getting that booster dose out there. If we are experiencing a major wave and that booster dose needs to be delivered widely and quickly, those mass vaccination clinics are the perfect settings for that because we can get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people through in a single day. If it's not quite as urgent, if case levels are low, if the booster dose isn't going to be a real game changer in terms of preventing mass spread, then we'll look to the traditional distribution mechanisms, pharmacies, the healthcare system, et cetera. So we will be there if that need arises quickly and we really need that large capacity, absolutely. Otherwise, again, kind of that transition from response mode, from pandemic, endemic, we'll look for those traditional means to help meet that need. But we're here if things are changing quickly, things are changing rapidly, we'll have that volunteer capacity available and we'll be ready to stand up. Right now, our current game plan is demobilized all of our equipment, a lot of the volunteers. If there is a sudden need that does arise, we hope to be ready within 72 hours or so, we can get one back up. We want it to be able to be activated relatively quickly should the need arise. So otherwise, again, we'll be looking to formally demobilize likely around the end of the month, go into that ongoing maintenance mode, moving from pandemic to endemic, but we'll of course be ready if the time comes. The last thing I will mention is starting next week, we're going to be starting our after action review of the response. I know public health has already started that internally among themselves. We're going to be working with obviously DEM and public health, as well as some other partners that we had brought into the Emergency Operations Center fold. We'll be spending honestly a couple of months conducting a few surveys, a few focus group conversations, and basically reviewing the lessons learned. Here's what we did. Here's what we could have done better. Here's what we want to build on for next time, and putting together an improvement plan and some recommendations for us here in the EOC. And then once that's completed here in a few months, I doubt we'll be doing these Monday morning briefings by then. At least I hope we've managed to put these in the rearview mirror. But I'd love to come back to the commissioners and share the results of that after-action improvement plan. So that's the next big step for us as part of that demobilization process. Other than that, that's the end of my report, barring any commissioner questions.
Any questions for Willie, Kate, or Greg?
Thanks to Willie for all the work from the volunteers and DEM and the EOC. And I really do look forward to seeing the data and the analysis of that after action. Are you guys, am I echoey for people? No?
Okay. No, but you're not very loud.
Okay, I can swallow the mic. We move back to these. We did create feedback, unfortunately, with the public comment earlier. So we're still working it out a little bit. But I guess my other question is sort of general for Dr. Barry, since we have a little bit of time. I think I asked this before, but is endemic a noun now? Are we going to be an endemic? Is that a new way to talk about it? Because I hear Willie just said it, and I've said it too.
Endemic is usually an adjective, but I think we're all finding new ways to use our to navigate this language, which was not a norm for most of us. But I do think that COVID-19 can safely be called an endemic pathogen, and that we are moving into the endemic phase. And I think we are often careful to say we are moving into. We are not definitively in the endemic phase. We do think that that will come. There will be likely, we do anticipate there will time will be a time where this more regularly moves like the flu, like a more severe version of the flu, but moves in a seasonal pattern. We have not really settled into that pattern yet. We still are seeing surges whenever mitigations are lifted. I do think right now, we are in a different place than we were because so many people have some degree of immunity. And so I think this is largely how we're going to start making that transition, but we don't know that for sure. We have to follow our case numbers, follow our hospitalizations closely over the coming months. But my colleague, Jeff Duchin in King County, I think made a really good point when he was interviewed recently on this topic, is now is the time to lay the foundation of our resilience to this virus. We likely have a few months before anything spikes again, if it's going to. And so now is really the time to make those investments. From our public health end, that means that we are really setting the policies and procedures and making sure our staff are ready to respond, that we have all of that in place. But also now is the time, if you operate a facility, to take a look at your ventilation system, make sure you know how you would respond if we had a spike in cases. I think this is kind of along the lines of a lot of what Willie does, which is we prepare for subsequent bad things that could happen. And that preparation is best done not when you are putting out fires everywhere, that that preparation is best done right now. So make sure that you know how to keep yourself and your family safe. Make sure that you know what our COVID-19 case rates are so that your behavior can adjust if and when those case numbers go back up again.
That's very helpful. Thank you. And then using your Epi crystal ball, which we know is infallible now, right? What do you... You know, it's a real unknown in front of us at this point. You know, how many of these layered mitigations are people going to take advantage of? What do you see as the most probable course? I mean, I would guess that there's going to be a spike with the with the removal of mandates and requirements and going to recommendations. What does the Epi curve tell us? The projection tell us about what's going to happen from, you know, 50% less mitigations right now, or whatever we're going to get?
We anticipate that we will likely see a small surge in cases starting a couple weeks from now. Usually those start about 2 to 3 weeks after we remove a mitigation. But so far, it's looking like it's likely to be small. A couple of things that drive that is that we are not seeing the kind of super spreader events we saw before. The biggest area of focus for us right now is the schools. That is the place where we bring a lot of, in many cases, unvaccinated people very close together. And so from our end, that's where we're focusing our attentions the most to make sure that we can mitigate that spread should we start to see a rise in cases there. But it is a hopeful time because it's getting warmer. And so we're starting to move outside. We can move more activities outside. And so likely we are not anticipating a significant surge until closer to fall, but it really depends on what we see coming out of the UK. That could certainly change the trajectory. And of course, a new variant can always change the trajectory. So the further you get from today, the harder it is to make predictions. And there's a lot more variables right now, so it's harder to have a very firm projection at this moment, but it will get clearer as we move through the next couple of weeks.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. Oh, Kate.
I have another question for Dr. Berry. I realize I just lost probably my 100th earring of the pandemic from taking masks on and off. This question isn't about my earrings, but if anyone sees it, let me know. But it's about what kind of masks should we be wearing now in this phase? You know, we've learned so much about masking, about are we protecting ourselves? Are we protecting others? Where are we in that for someone who is, you know, I suspect I know the answer for someone who's immunocompromised, but for someone who is relatively young and healthy, how should we be thinking about masking? What should we be wearing?
For indoor spaces, I do recommend kind of getting the best bang for your buck. And so a KN95 or a KF94 are really a good option for most people. They do a really good job at protecting you and protecting others, as long as they are comfortable enough for you. As case numbers go down, you know, the space before taking off your mask can be scaling down the strength of your mask. So something like a surgical mask can be pretty appropriate as well. But if you're really trying to protect yourself, so when I was talking to the schools, for example, and some teachers who were nervous about going back to school with a bunch of unmasked and largely unvaccinated kids, I strongly recommend in that setting a KN95 or a KF94. It's going to provide you the most protection when the people around you are unmasked. So that's usually what I wear in most indoor settings. And then, you know, cloth masks can be a good option when case numbers are very low. And I think that's a kind of an appropriate way to navigate these mitigation measures is as case numbers get lower, things get less risky. And so unless you're very high risk, you can start to scale back the intensity of your mask or potentially unmask as well. And I still want to encourage folks to make informed decisions about where you unmask. Even after we get less than 100 cases per 100,000, there are some places that even if it were allowed, I would wear a mask. So like a plane or a bus, a place where you have a ton of people in an unventilated space that are in many cases going to be unmasked when those mandates go away, I would wear a high quality mask there. But I would have a lower threshold to unmask actually in an open space like a big grocery store where you have a lot more air movement in that space.
Thank you for that. Thanks, you guys, for being our steady Eddies throughout this whole thing. I mean, as I said earlier, I spent some time reflecting or kind of putting myself back in the
18 months ago time, and kind of some of the chaos. I remember when I was working at the Maritime Center and we were just closing our doors, and it's been quite a time we've been through together. I mean, I appreciate your leadership and steadiness and guidance. And glad to be in a longboat with you guys, rowing across the bay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Yeah.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.